Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
But first this morning, I'm joined in the studio by Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Public Expenditure, the National Development Plan Delivery and Reform. And you're very welcome, Minister.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you for coming in today. I was just reading Pat Leahy's piece in the Irish Times this morning. He says immigration, and specifically the accommodation arrangements for asylum seekers, that they have become the hot button issue now, political issue for this year, for 2024. Do you agree?
I do believe it'll be a very defining theme of this year here in Ireland, just as it will be all over the world. We are not at all unique in having to confront what are the consequences of migration that's now intensifying due to war and due to climate change. And to put that in context, it will happen after Ireland has provided accommodation through our society and through the state for 101,000 people that weren't living in our country around 18 months ago.
I know you say it's a common problem around the world, but we've got to talk specifically about how we've dealt with it here, because this was the first week that we have heard the Minister for Integration talk about these new bills that are planned for reception centres. And this is 22 months on now from the start of the war in Ukraine. Do you accept that the malaise is at least partly to blame because there's a lack of planning here on the part of the government?
I would respectfully make a different case than that. And the reason why I would is the ability that we have had to provide accommodation of such scale for over 100,000 people. We have been in an emergency situation because of the duration of the war, and also because the number of people who are applying for international protection in our country, the growth in that has exceeded any reasonable expectations that we could have had.
But we have known for some time, and it was the government that told us we'd have between 100 and 200,000 people here from Ukraine. So, and that was 22 months ago, very early days of the war.
But what I think has changed is, number one, the duration of stay for those who are coming to our country from Ukraine. And number two, in addition to the Ukrainian needs that we've had, that you've just touched on, we've also, in parallel to that, seen a really significant growth in the number of people who are coming to Ireland, not from Ukraine, but are seeking international protection. Mm-hmm. And what we now need to do is transfer gradually out of an emergency situation where we are having to improvise very regularly to find accommodation, to move to a plan that can give certainty to our society insofar as we can regarding how we can fairly accommodate challenges that are there when a large number of people move into a country.
I mean, I remember how affected you were the morning after the Dublin riots when you came in to see us here. I mean, there is, it seems, a large swathe now of our population who feel disenfranchised and completely disengaged from government and unwilling to listen.
I don't accept the link between what happened at the end of November and the migration debate that is there. I don't accept there was a link. I believe what happened that night, particularly in O'Connell Street, was not driven by any of the political or social issues that we are talking about here. I fully understand and fully accept that if your family worried about will your own child have a place in a school, worried about can a sick family member access a GP, you have that concern. And then on the other hand, you see our population growing so quickly for the reasons we've outlined. I understand that concern there. On the other hand, I don't believe there's any cause worth scaring a child over or upsetting a child over who's looking to move into one of these centres.
Mm-hmm. Are you referring specifically to what happened in Ross Grey when the first families were moved in this week?
That, but I've also seen other examples of it where you can see families, including children, that are moving into centres in scenes that can be very, very strained. And I can see the upset that can cause. And just on a personal level, I don't believe there are causes out there that are worth scaring children who are already in a state of turmoil that is beyond my own imagination. What we need to do is do two things. Firstly, continuing with our efforts to put in place a plan that can show the country how we can deal with this in the time ahead, because this challenge will be with us for some time. And then secondly, showing that we have a system that's been implemented fairly, with 800 people deported from our country there last year, the number of people who are working in managing citizenship and international protection issues has doubled in the Department of Justice, and we have hugely speeded up the amount of time involved in processing applications. And I hope we can demonstrate to our country our ability to do both of those things.
But you see, the community in Ross Grey, they feel aggrieved because their only hotel, they feel, has been snatched away from them. Do you understand that?
I've been at pains to recognise that there are concerns that are raised there. And I've talked about the very human feeling of somebody who's worried about what this could mean for a GP service. Of course, I do recognise that. But I think it's also important as a member of government just to emphasise that the changes that we're responding back to are confronting all countries. We have a system that is working, that can work, and I believe is working fairly and efficiently in dealing with issues of, you know, fairness regarding those who are coming into our country. We have a rules-based system, but then we have those in our country who legally and fairly are looking for support at a time of global turmoil, and we have to do our best to respond back to that.
But are you in favour now of ending this situation we see at the moment, where there is an emergency, almost panicked call out for accommodation? All sources of private accommodation are explored and used if they can be, to something else, to this reception centre model?
I think in truth, we will be talking about a gradual transition. I don't think it is honest to be able to say we can really quickly move from an emergency situation to one that can be more gradual. And talking about the medium term, there will be a period of transition. And the reason why I say that is, you know, the figures alone remind us of the challenge that we have. And let me use, for example, the issue we have of those who are moving to our country in a family situation. Between the start of last year and the end of September, we would have seen around 300 families, you know, move to our country. From the start of October to the end of the year, it went up to 500. In the first 4 weeks of this year, and the end of last year, it went up to over 700. So we've seen a really significant change in the composition of those who are coming to our country while the numbers go up, which means we'll continue to need to provide short-term accommodation. But yes, we want to move to a more stable way too of dealing with this.
So then in Ross Grey, we heard after the meeting that was held between local representatives and the Minister for Integration last night that there's going to be some move to acquire the other closed hotel in the town and transform that into a community-run hotel. Are you aware of those plans, or that that commitment has been given?
I've seen the media reports of it, and I have seen the indication that has been given that it's going to be considered and to see if we can do it. I'm not aware of the detail further beyond that.
Leo Varadkar then said yesterday there will be additional supports given to the communities who've taken in most asylum seekers and refugees. Has that been costed? Are you across that from an expenditure point of view?
Well, I think in fairness to the Taoiseach, he outlined the process in relation to this very clearly. Like on an overall national level, we're after completing two very big budgets in recent years. And the reason why the expenditure figures and spending figures have been so big is every single cent we have wanted to spend on getting more nurses, building more schools, getting more doctors into rural communities in particular, we have gone ahead and spent that money anyway. And dealing with all of the issues of people coming into our country and seeking to provide accommodation at a time of war, we spent that separately on top of meeting the day-to-day needs that our society and communities have. Because our public finances, because they've been well managed, have allowed us to do it. And what the Taoiseach said yesterday, which I think is a very reasonable approach and something I'll certainly be working with my colleagues in government on, is that if we're doing this nationally, and we know increasingly that a number of communities have been asked to do a lot, we need to see what more we can do for those local communities in the time ahead. What the Taoiseach has asked is that government departments come back to his department in the coming weeks, what they believe can be done during the year, and then we will scope out the cost then at that point.
Okay, it's difficult to see how that would work in practice. You know, how can you employ more doctors in a town or increase the number of teachers in a town? You know, can you see how it might work? Can you explain how it might work?
Yes, I can. But this is against the context of nationally, we have been increasing our spending by between 5% and 6% per year over the last 2 years to go ahead and get those nurses anyway, to go ahead and get those doctors anyway. And I hand on heart can say what we've been able to do is split out the money we need to spend to deal with international protection, to deal with refugees and to support them fairly and compassionately. And that has not taken the place of money that we would spend in wanting to build a new home.
Okay.
But to give you, to answer your question specifically, we have a good model, for example, in what Minister Hedda Humphreys has rolled out on behalf of government. We've had a community recognition and support fund in place that has allowed local communities to apply for funding on things they think could make a difference to them while they're accommodating people and needs, which 2 years ago we thought we'd never have to do.
All right. And we've had some representatives from those communities disputing that that plan is actually working and that they say it's difficult to access those funds. But can I move on in a way? Because Minister Joe O'Brien said yesterday on Drive Time that the decision to hand that hotel over was made by the owner, was a commercial business decision. And that leads me into what's been happening in hospitality. And we were talking about this on the programme on Monday. We had a number of restaurant owners saying, doesn't matter how busy we are, we cannot make money. We cannot make a profit. And that's why they say so many are closing. Do you think that now is the time for the government to revisit the decision on the VAT rate for the hospitality industry?
I believe the VAT rate we have in the hospitality sector at the moment went up from 9%. There is the right one, and I would not be anticipating the government would revise it. We brought down the VAT rate at a time in which the hospitality sector was closed. And the Finance Act is done, and I don't believe, nor would I support, changing that VAT rate again.
Do you think they need any sort of additional support, well, given what we've seen?
Minister McGrath this morning, the Minister for Finance, has indicated that he's willing to consider changes now in relation to the debt warehousing scheme in response back to the issues that have been raised. During the era of COVID, I and Minister McGrath, on behalf of the government, invested billions of euros in supporting our hospitality sector because of the huge value we place upon them and the huge work that they do. They're such an important part of our economy and our society. And as you know, we had around 3.2 billion euro worth of tax that was warehoused during the period of COVID. We know that it's coming back up now for further payment in May. Payments are already being made on us. And the minister has indicated that he's willing to consider changes to look at how we can respond back.
And you hope,
to issues
you hope
that
that's going to be enough despite all of the closures that we've seen?
I believe it can make a difference. We do also have to be fair in relation to this issue. If I look at the tax warehousing issue, for example, at its peak, the amount of tax that was warehoused was around 3.2 billion euro. It now stands at 1.8 billion euro. So around 1.4 billion euro of that tax has now been paid by businesses, I'm sure many of which struggled to pay that tax. We need to be aware of that and be fair to them too. But I do believe that any change that Michael would bring forward would be one that could make a material difference to those businesses, which we really value and want to support.
A lot of them cite energy costs as well. And we know that energy costs for regular consumers, we've seen this week two announcements, at least perhaps three, that the prices are coming down. Dara Cassidy from bonkers.ie, though, reminds us that even if they come down further, he expects that next winter we will be paying around 50% more than we would have in normal times, let's call them. And he thinks there will be need for more government supports next year.
Well, it's January this year. And what we've done throughout many different challenges that we've got our way through is year by year, month by month, evaluate where we are and see if support is needed. Dara and bonkers.ie may well be able to forecast what's happening in 2024, but I think we need to be cautious and humble in trying to predict what the future will bring. We recognise the challenges that are there at the moment, and this is the reason why Minister Coveney is in the process of rolling out a cost of doing business support scheme at the moment, over 250 million euro of money that's been made available to businesses really quickly to help them with what we appreciate is a tough time in the hospitality sector at the moment. And on the supports that we're making available to households at the moment, we're only in the process now of making the second grant out of three available for this year. I hope we will see a very different situation later on in the year and next year with regards to the cost of energy.
OK, but you're not planning on putting in place a budget line for supports for next year. That's not on your agenda, is what you're saying.
Well, we're not planning any further support for this year. We have a budget which we're implementing. We have, for example, further cost of living support payments that are being made available by the Department of Social Protection, by Minister Humphreys at the moment. And we laid out a plan for this year. What budget 2024 will bring is a matter we'll deal with in budget 2025. Sorry, is a matter we'll deal with in September 2024.
And who might be delivering it? But we'll talk about that as well, I'm sure. Now, the National Development Plan, the ESRI said last week that the scale of investment needs to increase, and there's a particular focus there on housing. You're facing a real dilemma here because it's the last year of this current government. You're being given clear evidence now that what you've done isn't enough, and you won't have time to sort that out ahead of the next election.
But between 2020 and the end of 2023, there will be 100,000 more homes will have been built in our country, despite a pandemic, despite the cost of building a home going through the roof.
But our targets aren't right even, and we're hearing this increasingly now. The drum is beating around this need for 60,000 houses a year. Our targets were never right. So when you tell us that targets have been met and even exceeded, you're not even halfway to solving the problem.
So amidst all the figures, I have to also recognise the human story in all of this. Which we're also aware of, those who are worried about whether they can't afford their rent, those who are worried they mightn't be able to buy a home in the future. It's really welcome that, for example, we're seeing 300 to 400 more people buying their first home now on nearly every week through access to Help to Buy. We've always accepted that where we are with our targets at the moment, that there's a gap between that and the number of homes that people that we accept need to be built within our country. But over the last number of years, there hasn't been the capacity to go far beyond the targets that we've had in place.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the construction sector was closed, Claire,
well,
and we were then in a position where
we had them in here yesterday and they said, set the target at 60,000. There's a slowdown in the commercial sector.
Yeah.
We can meet it.
That's fair enough. And the government is going to consider what the targets are and what the appropriate targets will be for the years ahead. And Minister O'Brien is looking at that at the moment. But the idea that we could have set targets that are way ahead of what we have just delivered at a time in which the construction sector was closed, at a time in which our economy was in full employment, and at the time in which construction inflation became so high, like that is a kind of revisionism of the past that I wouldn't have been credible and couldn't have been delivered. What we are now saying is on the back of the success that we've had while we want to build more homes, in building, I hope, around 30,000 homes last year. We'll build more this year. We'll build even more next year. And whenever the election comes, while of course we will be faced with all of the challenges that are there of our country wanting us to build more homes, the government will also be able to point to all the new homes that are being built, how much more will be built in the time ahead.
I suppose my point is, and Alan Barrett said this when he was talking about the report, Alan Barrett from the ESRI, that our infrastructure is creaking. And surely that's not how you would want to go into an election cycle.
This is the same ESRI that have warned us about not making decisions that can lead to inflation growing within our economy. It's the same ESRI that have pointed out that because we're at full employment, it's difficult to find the people and resources to do even more. And of course, it's the same ESRI that have provided a very valuable report now regarding what we can do in the future and how we can manage this. Of course, I'm so aware of the challenges that are there. And when we talk about infrastructure, that's schools, it's homes, it's our public transport,
it's also
of the challenges that are there.
It's a political point. And I
oh,
see what you're saying. I hear what you're saying about the ESRI. You seem to be accusing them of speaking out of both sides of their mouth on issues.
Oh, I didn't make any such accusation.
But the point still remains.
Of course.
The infrastructure is creaking. And you have to, what are you selling to the electorate with that message?
So what we will be selling with the pressures that are there within our society that I know only too well is, for example, the fact that when at 2016, we were investing around 4 billion euro per year in our country's future. For this year, that figure is going to be 12.9 billion euro. What we will be saying is, well, all of the difficulties that we've had in the last few years with costs, with our construction sector closed, we'll have over 100,000 more homes new built. We have new school buildings being built all over the country. We have progress on things like, for example, how we are making our public transport fleet greener. And if we continue with this approach, which we can in the years ahead, we will do even more and we'll make more of a difference.
Now, the pay talks ended without success and you detailed the offer that was made, 8.5% over 2.5 years. The unions want more. They threatened strike action. They threatened to ballot on that front. And you said that you won't be threatened or you won't be influenced by threats of strike action. Do you not take that threat seriously?
I take it seriously, but as somebody who's been involved in these wage negotiations and lots of different points over a number of years now, you always do get to a point in which statements like this can be made, and it's happened before. What I want to do is put in place a further wage agreement that gives rewards the work that our public servants do, supports how our public services are delivered, and is affordable. You, for example, have been raising the really important points with me in the last part of our interview about the need to spend more on improving our public infrastructure. We're now about to talk about the need to do more in relation to public pay. I can't spend the same euro once. And what I want to do, if the opportunity is there to do so, is see can we reach agreement on a new on a new wage agreement.
Because I was reading Austin Hughes, I was talking in here to John Fitzgerald. They both said we have the money to do this and it's worth it for industrial peace, because we have seen what has happened in the UK when it comes to strikes in recent
times. And I've demonstrated my recognition of that by the wage agreements that we've had in place over the last number of years, that have delivered wage growth, that have allowed the number of people who are working in our public services to go from, in 2019, it was around 335,000 people. For this year, it'll be more than 400,000 people working in our public services. And I very much do want that agreement. In relation to the point about the money being available, which is, of course, a reference to our surpluses, have to bear in mind those surpluses are all delivered by corporate tax. That corporate tax revenue will decline. We went through 3 months of last year in which corporate tax didn't deliver the targets that we expected would. We shouldn't be using revenue that we know is going to go down to use for pay.
So we can't afford it. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I never said that. On the other hand, the fact that we've been able to bring forward a proposal of 2.9 billion euro, delivering wage growth of over 8%, shows that we can afford a wage agreement, and I'm committed to doing one. But I'm also really conscious of the fact that while I want to support and value the work that our public servants are doing, and I've shown that by the wage agreements we've secured and ratified in the past, ultimately, I want to make sure that whatever we agree to, not only can we afford it this year, but we can afford it next year as well.
What about restructuring the offer so that the increases are front loaded?
So those matters of detail and those matters of negotiation are better dealt with within the Workplace Relations Commission. I really hoped we would have been in a position to get an agreement there last year. Very much hoped when we went in there last week that we would have been able to get an agreement. I hope those who are representing our public service employees can consider the value of what we've put forward. And if there's an opportunity to engage on this again, we will.
It's interesting to hear that you hoped there was a deal last year, because the unions say they were nonplussed. They didn't know why negotiations weren't happening last year.
They were happening last year.
And there was a suggestion that perhaps the government side was waiting them out to see if inflation would fall, which it did.
Not really. We always had an expectation inflation was going to fall. In each of the budgets we've done over the last 2 years, we laid out very clearly our expectation that inflation would come down this year and begin to come down in the second half of last year. And thank God it has. So all that is happening is what I said would happen. My preference and strong preference would have been to have secured an agreement as while we still had another agreement in place, which we had last year. But a number of issues came up in relation to, for example, the FEMPI legislation. And that, just for some of your listeners who won't be aware of it, that's
I think a lot of people, very many people live through that and know what it is.
Well, but I know everybody's aware of the consequences of it, but I don't think what many people would have been aware of is just a small bit of it left in our statute books. There were some claims made in relation to it that took a few weeks to deal with. And that was just another cause of delay.
Listen, I want to talk about your own situation now. And you have answered very many questions on this. But just to be clear, are you going to contest the next general election in Dublin Central?
Yes.
Have you ambitions to be Taoiseach or Fine Gael leader?
No.
Not at all?
I've answered this question on many different occasions, Claire.
I just think it's interesting because people talk a lot about your future, and we're told, you know, there is no campaign for you to lead out the IMF. So if we look ahead to the aftermath of the next election, are you telling us that you would be happy to be a backbencher in opposition?
Well, implicit in that is that I would be supported by the people of Dublin Central and elected by them in the next general election, which would be a great honour if that happened. And I'll serve in any way that I can. I have been incredibly lucky and humbled to be trusted by Leo Varadkar in particular to serve in government over a number of years. I hugely, hugely enjoy what I do, and I'm really conscious of the privilege and responsibility in doing it.
So you would, and you would serve as an opposition TD on the backbenches?
Well, actually, come the next general election, I don't have an ambition for Fine Gael to be in opposition. Come the next general election, I will be making the case for Fine Gael having the opportunity to serve another term in government to continue with the work that we are doing.
So just looking at that scenario then, let's say Michael McGrath takes the role of EU Commissioner. Do you feel that puts more pressure on you then to remain in one of the finance portfolios?
Oh, look, Claire, I think this is hypothetical after hypothetical. I mean, we have covered off, you know, the only question and theme we haven't covered off here are the lotto numbers and what's going to happen this weekend, right? And
well, listen, I think I'd probably have a better chance of getting the answers if I asked you about the lotto numbers, because you don't seem to want to go there.
Well, I've actually, you put a few questions to me and I answered them pretty simply and bluntly, which I did, and I've answered them in the past. My hands are full with what I'm doing at the moment. I really enjoy doing it. I'm lucky to do it. And that's where my energy and focus lies.
Listen, we are just weeks away from two referendums. Who is the director of that campaign for your own party?
The Taoiseach, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't made that appointment yet.
Does that say a lot about how important those referendums are to the government?
No, not at all. I mean, in my experience, these kind of appointments are normally made around, a few months in the lead up to the referendum.
Because the wording hasn't been agreed yet either.
Well, the detail of all of that would be dealt with by government shortly. The fact that we are going ahead with these referenda is something that I really welcome. And it happened after an awful lot of debate and evaluation in government. And we, of course, as political parties, rather than as a government, conscious of the legal environment at referendum time, will be making the case for the passage of these campaigns and the referendum and the amendments. And I'll certainly play my part in that.
Minister, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Claire.
Minister for Public Expenditure, Pascal Donoghue. We'll take a break.